Thank you for joining us today for a message from the Word of God. What follows is a recording from one of our live services at Gooch Lane Church of Christ in Huntsville, Alabama. If you're ever in the area, we'd love to have you join us in person. And if you like what you hear today, you can visit us online at teachingtruth.org, where we have videos, weekly articles on biblical topics, information about our services, and more.
If you'd like to go ahead and open up to Job chapter 2, we're going to be over there in just a second. Last week, we talked about God remembering. We used three examples that he remembered. He remembered Noah and the animals in the ark. He remembered Abraham as he was willing to save Lot out of Sodom and Gomorrah. And then he remembered Israel as he brought them up out of the land of Egypt. As I was thinking through those thoughts last week and then continued on this week as well, that idea of remembering in the Bible has just continued to intrigue me. And I thought it might be appropriate this week if we kind of turned it around a little bit. And rather than God remembering, to think about when people have called on God to remember. And as I looked through all of the references to that, it was a little bit hard to figure out exactly how to narrow this down. You had, for example, Hannah calling on God to remember her so that she could have a child. You had King Hezekiah calling on God to remember him so he could have a longer life. You had Moses calling on God to remember his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So just many, many examples. But there were two men who really stood out, I think, in calling on God to remember them. And this morning, what I'd like to do is to talk about these two men who are from very different times in history and very different circumstances in what God tells us about them, but yet what they share in common is that on several occasions, in at least their time of testing that they were going through, that they're crying out for God to remember them. And so let's just consider that for a few minutes this morning, and then we're going to make some application to ourselves. The book of Job is a familiar book to most people, whether we know it well or not. It's still a familiar story of a man who's going to go through very intense suffering. And if you look in chapter 1, we're not going to take time to read all of that this morning, but I will remind you of what we find in that chapter, which really we might just sum up as Job being decreated. And what I mean by that is his storyline here at the beginning is kind of like the storyline when God is bringing judgment on someone and began just slowly and surely to take away the blessings that kind of correspond to the creation. We find that with Job here. We know that Job lost his children. What's the first command God gives to man and woman? It's to go and be fruitful and multiply, which Job had done. And yet, what happens? Job's children are taken away. Their lives are lost. We also find that the lives of his livestock are taken from him. So they're out in the field, and God gives permission to Satan to bring destruction there. And so we find his animals being taken from him. But I think what may correspond the most to those early days of creation and decreation is what his wife says to him after Job has been in this terrible, terrible condition. His health is taken from him, which we'll talk about here in just a second. His wife comes to him, and the text brings out that she made the statement, "Why don't you just curse God and die?" Which immediately takes us to the Garden of Eden, where as Eve is handing the fruit to Adam, that's exactly what she's asking him to do, that God has said, do not eat from this tree, because in the day that you eat of it, you will surely die. Here she hands him that fruit. And so metaphorically, we might say, that's what Job's wife is doing to him. She's saying to him, why don't you just end this agreement that you've got? Why don't you just acknowledge that God has penalized you and done these bad things to you? He's held back from you. So just in a sense, eat from the fruit and you'll die also. And then we find that Job, after all is said and done, is at the very basis of creation, the very basis of humanity. And I just want to notice what he says, or what's said about him here in chapter 2, verse 8. His health has been taken, his family's been taken, his wealth has been taken, his wife is not supporting him, in fact, encouraging him to end his relationship with God. And this is what he's brought down to in verse 8, that he took a piece of broken pottery with it, with which to scrape himself while he sat in the ashes. Which is reminiscent of something Abraham said. As Abraham approached God in Genesis 18, the text tells us, "Behold, I have undertaken to speak to the Lord, I who am but dust and ashes." That's where Job is at this point. Everything's gone except for his humanity alone, and even that's in question. And so as we think about the book of Job overall, I think what we're seeing within this is a reflection on what it means to be human and to what that means in relationship to God. Whenever you study the book of Job, there are a number of topics in it. Like most books of the Bible, Job's kind of like a diamond. Just shine it in a little different direction and you'll get a different shimmer off of it. But yet one thing that's consistent through the book is here is a man who has had everything taken from him, and now he's got to contend with what that means not only in being human, but also in what it means in his relationship to God. And we understand then, because of that, some of these questions that Job is going to ask as God is called on to remember, as Job is making these statements. In fact, you look at where all of this starts, and it's Job just simply saying, "I wish I had never been born." And I want you to notice the three times that he calls on God to remember. As we look over to chapter 7 of the book, we're going to find the first of these three that we'll look at. In chapter 7 and verse 7, Job has gone through a series of his friends' addresses here, where they're telling him just to admit that he's a sinful man. That's why all of this has happened. Job is saying, "I'm not a sinful man. That's not why all of this has happened." So you've got this ordeal going on in the background. And finally, Job says this to God. He says, "Remember that my life is a breath. My eye will never again see good." Is that interesting? That as he cries out to God, he says, "You need to remember just how ephemeral I am. Remember just how less I am than you are." And that brings him to make some fairly serious remarks to God. So much of this would be beneficial for us to read, but we're going to narrow it down. Look down to verses 17 and 18. Whereas he's made this statement to God, he now says, "What is man that you make so much of him and that you set your heart on him, visit him every morning and test him every minute or every moment?" You're looking here at a man who has lost everything and he's crying to God and he's saying, "What's the deal with all of this? Don't you know that I'm but a breath? Don't you know I'm never going to see good again in my life?" He continues on, verse 21, "Why do you not pardon my transgression and take away my iniquity? For now I shall lie in the earth. You will seek me, but I shall not be." He says, "When all of this is over, I'm just going to be gone. Remember that my life is a breath." Let's look at his second statement. If we go over just a bit further in chapter 10, looking down to verses 8 and 9, the speeches have continued. The accusations are ratcheting up against Job. And he says in verse 8, "Your hand fashioned and made me, and now you have destroyed me altogether. Remember that you have made me like clay, and will you return me to the dust?" Job says, You got to remember that my life is but a breath. And now he asked God to remember, you're the one responsible for my creation. You're the one responsible for making me. Again, let's look and see what follows here. You go down to verse 18 of the same chapter. Here's what Job asks of God. He says, why did you bring me out from the womb? Would that I had died before any eye had seen me, and were as though I had not been carried from the womb to the grave. Are not my days few? Then cease and leave me alone, that I may find a little cheer before I go. And I shall not return to the land of darkness and deep shadow, the land of gloom, like thick darkness, like deep shadow, without any order, where light is as thick as darkness. Job says, Lord, it's like you've broken the humanity covenant with me. If you look really closely at those verses that we just read, it sounds a whole lot like the uncreated earth. Darkness, thick darkness, chaos going on. He says to the Lord, that's what I'm feeling like now, and yet you made me. We then look at the third remember in chapter 14. In chapter 14, we look to verse 13. And he says, oh, that you would hide me in Sheol, that you would conceal me until your wrath is past, that you would appoint me a set time and remember me. I don't know what Job felt about the afterlife. The Old Testament's a little difficult to figure out what the leading thought might have been. But yet here's Job, and he's saying to the Lord, why don't you just put me in Sheol? Why don't you just put me in the grave until all of this is over? And what we find then in what's going to follow is that Job is going to have this Ecclesiastes moment where he's talking about death and dying and what that means and what it doesn't mean. But he's trying to figure out what it's all about. Now I want you to look at the three remembers here that we have from Job. Job says, remember that middle question. You brought me into this world. And then the first question, remember that you are the one who sustains me. You're the one who gives me breath. You're the one who has done this. And then the third, remember that after all of it's over, that's where I'm going to hopefully meet you again. At the beginning, at the middle, and at the end. Job is saying to God, I need you to remember me. One thing about the book of Job is that oftentimes when we study it in its shorthand version of chapter 1 and then jump to the end where Job is blessed, we miss what the book is all about. And that's where God has allowed Job, a good man, a righteous man, a faithful man, to be decreated. Now consider that in relation to the other decreations. Almost always what we're finding is that God is the one who's doing the decreating, and it's being done to a person or a group of people who have forgotten Him and have behaved themselves unrighteously. So He's rocking their world to get their attention. But yet here we've got a good man. We've got Satan being allowed to do the decreating here, while God takes a very silent view, at least from Job's standpoint, as Job grapples with all of this, ultimately boiling down to, when everything is taken away, when my world has been totally decreated, will I stay faithful to God? And though we find many low points in the life of Job, we find that's exactly what he's trying to do. Okay, let that sit for a minute. We now turn our attention to a very different time. We don't know exactly when Job lived. Likely pretty early in the Bible story. Nehemiah is coming fairly late in our history of the Old Testament. Here we've had the children of Israel in a very difficult situation. And now we're going to find a man who is going to seek to revive the spiritual community. As Job was reckoning with basic raw human survival, here's a man who's grappling with the spiritual survival of the community. Just to set things up a bit for this storyline, the book of Nehemiah is all about Jerusalem being recreated. Why were they decreated? Well, it was a standard reason. It was because of their wickedness. In fact, if you're here in the book of Nehemiah, we'll look at chapter 1. Listen to what Nehemiah says concerning his people. He says, "We have acted very corruptly," he's praying this to God, "against you, and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, and the rules that you commanded your servant Moses. Remember the word that you commanded your servant Moses, saying, 'If you are unfaithful, I will scatter you among the peoples.'" Well, that's exactly what happened. The people had misbehaved. They had not kept the rules and the statutes of God. God gave them prophet after prophet after prophet. God gave them many opportunities to repent. They refused to do it, and God sent them off into captivity. But now He's allowing them to come back. Now He's allowing this city of God, as it was supposed to be rebuilt, to give them another opportunity. And it's Nehemiah who's seeking to do that. Here's a man, quite likely, never had visited Jerusalem. In his life, had never been there. And yet he's making the decision to go to rebuild that city. And what the book is primarily going to focus on is the rebuilding of those walls of the city. A monumental task. What's intriguing about this is that throughout the book, Nehemiah is going to ask God to remember. I want to note a few of those with you. Let's look first of all, beginning in chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 19. Nehemiah has not taken the pay that would be due him as a leader. And if you notice down in verse 19, after all of this, he's not taken anything. In fact, he's been just the opposite. He's been generous. He says, "Remember for my good, O my God, all that I have done for this people." As he prays to the Lord, he says, "I want you to remember what I'm doing here." That sounds rather odd to us. But yet here's Nehemiah saying, "I'm taking nothing from them. I am doing nothing that a leader has full right to do, and I want you to remember that," as he prays to God. Let's go a little bit further. Going over toward the end of the book, we get to chapter 13, and we find that times have been tumultuous. Nehemiah will get something good going, and then he goes back to serve as king for a little while, and he returns, and it's not going well anymore, and he has to start over. That's just kind of the story of this last section. And in verse 14, in a second call for remembrance, he says, "Remember me, O my God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for His service." He says, "I have given to this people. I've been generous to this people. I've continued in these reform efforts. Remember what I'm doing." Kind of staying in that same vein of thought, we go down to verse 29. As he's trying to get the spiritual side of things restored. Verse 29, he says, "Remember them, O my God, because they have desecrated the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites." A little bit different here. This time, he's saying, "Remember those who are messing things up." And that's in contrast to him who's been trying to purify. So in a sense, it's remember the purification that I've done while also remembering those who have tried to mess up all that's been done. And then as he brings his book to a close, finally down in verse 31, he simply concludes by saying, "Remember me, O my God, for good." Which might put us in a creation frame of mind. Where God is saying here about Nehemiah as he seeks to recreate this place, it is a good thing. And as Nehemiah prays to God, he says, "I want you to remember the good that I've done." So who have we got? We've got one man who is dealing with basic, raw humanity. what does it mean to be human? On the other hand, we've got a man who's dealing with the basic question of how do you keep a spiritual community alive? Let's look at some commonalities that they have. You look at both of these books, these two men, very different situations, very different time periods they're living in, yet what we find is that neither of these men received a direct message from God relating to what they were going through. Now we know at the end of the book of Job that God does come to Job with a very long speech, but it's not about what he's gone through. It's a reminder of who God is. It's a reminder that God knows what's going on and not to doubt that. But yet, as far as we know, Job never got an answer, at least on this side of eternity, about why all of this was happening to him. Why he lost his family, why he lost his possessions, why he lost his health. Nehemiah, he's going to say that the Lord put it in my heart to do this. We had never have a time described to us where God speaks to him, appears to him, sends a messenger, at least an official messenger to him. Neither received a direct message. Perhaps the bigger thing is both men are suffering for doing the right thing. We don't think about Nehemiah suffering. Read his story. You'll change your mind in a hurry when you read it from that perspective. Here's a man who had, for a Jew in that day, a pretty cushy job. He's a cupbearer to the king. He's living in royal circumstances. He's got the king's ear. He can talk to him. And yet, he's willing to give all of that up to go to this broken down Jerusalem to rebuild it. Both men are suffering for the right thing. And both men in that vein are having to deal with those who are encouraging them to fail. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, the three friends of Job, they're constantly giving him the wrong advice. Nehemiah, he's got people on the outside who are trying to stop him. He's got people on the inside who are trying to stop him. These men are having to try to stay to the course in doing good without a direct message from God, while there are plenty of direct messages from those who are trying to stop them. But here's the biggie. Neither of them gave up. Neither of them gave up. How easy it would have been for Job to curse God and say, "If you're going to let all this happen to me, forget it." Or with Nehemiah, we may can relate a little bit more to Nehemiah than others. You ever been in a situation where you're trying to be helpful, you're trying to get a group of people to do the right thing, and yet it's just like every good thing you do, it's being countered with something bad? The old statement, no good deed goes unpunished, we realize what that means. How easy it would have been for Nehemiah to say, "I had a pretty good thing going, and I'm going back." But neither man did. And of course, from our principle in the lesson this morning, both men are calling on God to remember. There's a lot of things that we should get from this, and I'm going to leave most of that to you. I'm not going to try to put up here every connection we need to make. This is for you to chew on this week, like I've been chewing on it last week. But there are two things that I do want to bring out that I think are important for us to consider, and then I want to leave you with one just for thought. As we think about what we're to learn from these two men, the vast amount of things, one of the big things that we should learn from them is there may be times when we feel like God has forgotten us. Or at the very least, that the blessings of God sure are being delayed. I've known people who've been in bad situations. I have never known anybody that I would categorize as being in Job's situation. Here's a man who has lost everything. But yet we can relate that there are times when we're going through things and it feels like that God is giving us the silent treatment. And maybe like Job, we're saying, "I just wish you would come. You know, just appoint a referee. Let's talk this thing out." When we consider that, I would suggest to us that it can be a time that brings us to take a look at our own humanity. whatever's going on behind the scenes that we don't know about. Whether this is a test, as Job was in, whether it's just sheer dumb luck that all of this is going on, these things can make us look at the very basis. Perhaps the passage from James, familiar passage, will help us. When James says, today or tomorrow we shall go to such and such town and spend a year there and trade and make a profit, yet you do not know what tomorrow will bring. For what is your life? You are a mist, or the old translations, a vapor that appears for a little time and then vanishes away. Don't you hear echoes of James' statement in Job's question? Don't you know I'm but a breath? Don't you know that I'm not around very long? And is this how we're going to deal with things? Is this what my life is going to be like? But it may be those very times that as we think about, that it reminds us, sometimes it takes some pretty stout lessons to bring us spiritual maturity. I want us to realize something with this. When life is going my way, when my job is good and my kids are behaving themselves and I'm happy with my spouse or I'm happy with my single life that I'm living and my health is good and my church is doing wonderfully, it's at those times I'm going to think, man, my faith is just as strong as it can be. Well, it may not be. It may just simply be that my faith has not really had much of a challenge to it. And it's easy to think that I'm really, really strong in these times, and it may be at those very times that decreation in my life is a way of promoting growth. I want to be real careful with this point. I want to be real careful with it. Because I don't think we ever need to view every negative thing that happens to us as God trying to throw something in our path to teach us a lesson. However, what we find is that God has said, when things are thrown in your path, learn how to deal with them and learn how to grow. Time and chance. We've all had it happen to us, haven't we? But yet what God is saying is, there may be some times in your life where I am going to take the bumpers out of the gutters and let you have a little bit of a difficult time so that you can realize where you need to be. That's another of the stories that we see in the book of Job. When at the end of his life, or the end of the story, Job says, I'd heard about you, but now I see. I repent of what I've done. You see a man who has come through a decreation, a recreated man, stronger in his relationship with God. We must be careful of assigning motive to God. Why would God let this happen to me? What we must understand, though, is that it's at these times in our lives where we have the opportunity for our faith to grow. I think we've got to remember that. Let me also suggest that it's at these times that, like Job, we can cry out to God to remember our humanity. We look at this story, and what we find in this is that there are going to be times in all of our lives where it just boils down to that basic, it's God and me. How are we going to deal with each other? And I think what Job is showing us here is we need to go ahead and just let God know what we're thinking, but to be careful and to be cautious to realize that God ultimately has our best interest at heart. That's what Job had to learn. Second lesson. There may be times when we need to call attention for the good that we've done. Doesn't that sound just troubling to say? Almost every sermon, you'll hear something about humility and don't draw attention to yourself. Yet, what Nehemiah is showing us is that there is an appropriate time that when you pray to God that you can say, remember the good that I'm doing. Now, why would we do that? Well, Nehemiah gives us the answer also. It's because that we are not seeking to highlight ourselves in any way, shape, or form. It's that we're calling attention to this good in the hopes that God is going to build on that to accomplish the greater goal that we're after. If my doing good is ever simply to make me look better, it's not good. But there are going to be many times when my good is for a purpose to create something better in others, to further a goal that God has established. And it's at those times that I can pray to Him and remember the good, call God to remember that good that I've done. And there may also be times that we pray to God, as we read over in chapter 13, to remember those who are seeking to stop good from occurring. Again, big note of caution here. I want to be very careful that I'm not viewing someone with whom I've got envy or jealousy or animosity as the enemy of good and praying for God to deal with them. But if there is someone who is purposely seeking to stop good from being done, whether that be a government official, whether that be a fellow Christian, whether that be just someone in the community, Nehemiah shows we ask God to remember that, to stop it, so that good things can take place, so that the ultimate good that I'm working for can be accomplished. Now, with all this said, there's one final thing I want to leave with you this morning. You ever study the Bible and you don't know if something's a big deal or not? I kind of had that moment this week, so I'll just share it with you. The last time that we come across a prayer that specifically says for God to remember me. Now, before I get any further with that, let me say, there's lots of places in the New Testament that have the idea. But if we're looking for the very last time that there is a recorded prayer with the specific words of remember me, it's the thief on the cross. He's the last one. And so here, as God has given mankind this salvation with Jesus dying on the cross, the thief realizes what's going on, and he says, remember me when you come into your kingdom. I don't want to suggest to you in any way, shape, or form that it's wrong for us to call on God to remember. We got a lot of examples. Yet, if this really is a big deal, it may be showing us that on this side of the cross, we need to put things in perspective. That if indeed we are calling on God to remember us, to remember ourselves, that we have a whole lot more understanding of things than Job or Nehemiah for two big reasons. First, we're reading their stories. They were living them. Second thing is, we've got the completed plan of salvation. And so as we think about that understanding, you and I have a much better grasp on what it means to be human because we've seen God become human. We've seen what it means to live like God intends for us to live, as humanity is supposed to live. We've seen that in the life of Jesus Christ. And I would say with that, we also understand a great deal more about suffering. We don't know exactly when Job lived, as I said, but Nehemiah, for certain, was living in the time of the law of Moses. Those of you who are kind of following along on this yearly reading that we started back in January, you've just gone through Deuteronomy. And that last chapter, last section really of Deuteronomy, is where God's saying, if you follow me, these are the blessings I'll give to you. If you curse me, these are the curses that I'm going to give to you. Very black and white. That's not what we live under. In fact, what we're living under is when Jesus says, if your enemy's hungry, feed him. Right? Somebody's doing something wrong to you, you do something good to him. But even more so, it's Jesus saying, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. You see, we're living in a time where we realize suffering is not necessarily dependent on wrongdoing. The book of Job teaches us that. The life of Christ teaches us that even more. And thus, when you and I are praying and we're considering humanity through the lens of Jesus Christ, and we're considering suffering through the lens of Jesus Christ, it's going to give us a very different picture of how God is working in our lives. So by no means do I suggest we never call on God to remember, but what I do suggest in a very big way is that when we call on Him to remember, we're asking Him to remember us by the fact that we're seeking to be like His Son. And ultimately, what that's going to do is to bring our prayers to make us more like Him. When I'm suffering, I want to be more like Jesus. When I'm dealing with the spiritual community's problems, I want to be more like Jesus. In every way, that's what I'm asking God to remember. Thank you for your good attention this morning. Hope this has been helpful and maybe stirring some thoughts that you've not had before, but for sure, to realize what it looks like to call on God to remember us. I want to mention something this week that I mentioned last week. God remembering, us calling on God to remember, in no way takes away from His omniscience. God knows everything. But remembering is always a call to action. You're calling on God to take action. Or God saying, I'm now ready to take action. And this is the good news of all of that, is God absolutely knows who we are. Nobody's got to remind Him that we're around. He knows. And what He desires is for us to be right with Him. God has said that when we become faithful to Him, He puts us in His book of remembrance. And simply what that means is when we have lived faithfully, whatever that means, whatever we've gone through, we've stayed true to God, like Job did, like Nehemiah did, like his son did ultimately. It means God's going to take action one of these days. And that action is going to be, I will fulfill the promise that I have given to you, that if you have been my people, I will be your God, not just now, but eternally. You'll come home to me. You'll live in my realm forever. And I hope as you think about that, if you are not a child of God, that you'll give it some serious attention and that you'll do some remembering today and take action to make your life right with God. Time's given to us. If you would like to become a Christian by being buried in the waters of baptism for the forgiveness of sins, or if you'd like for us to pray with you about a problem or sin that's plaguing you, we'll do that, so that our names are in that book of remembrance and we wait for that blessed action that God's going to take. If you need to respond, you can come now as we stand and sing together.
Thanks again for joining us today. If you have questions about anything you heard today or anything Bible related, you can use the contact form on our website at teachingtruth.org to submit a question and someone will be in touch. There's also lots of other great Bible content on our site as well. The web address again is teachingtruth.org. Once again, thanks for listening, and we hope to see you in person soon.